Hello, we are the Makes of History, with me, Faz, and Ross. Say hello, Ross.
Hello.
And welcome to Season 3, Episode 1
of...
Oh, we come up with a fucking title for this year, have we?
Oh, fuck no, we haven't really.
Oh, okay. The title will be in the title.
If you've clicked on it, you know what it is by this point.
Yeah, you know what the deal is. You know what the situation is, are you? Right, fucking new, fresh start. So we'll talk about what the... No, fuck that. Let's do the normal intro.
Yeah, how exactly doing, what mate? You doing.
Sorry, bruv. Sorry. I went off topic.
I'm offended by this.
I went off script. Hey, Timmy, what's going on? What do you know about the things that have gone on? And what do you wish had gone on before the things that had previously gone on happened?
Oh, I'm good. I've been, like, extra middle-aged this week. I've been planting trees from the garden centre.
Oh, nice. Where? Just fucking in people's houses? Or
yeah, just going to people's gardens.
Digging up carpets and just... Fuck out a tree in your land, you cunt.
darling, the oak fairy's visiting. 400-year-old oak in there.
Imagine that becomes a fucking folklore in the local Czech villages around one of the bits where you live. There's an English man that comes around and plants trees and yells. I don't know why they got pirate accents or whatever accent that was.
We're a nautical people.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so what's the deal with the trees, apart from the piracy?
No, yeah, essentially, like, because climate change is a thing and... Like, say in this week where it's like 27 degrees heat.
What? Already?
Yeah, it's fucking mental.
Oh, man, actually, yeah, I think you told me one day in the week how, yeah, I remember you saying it was mad.
Fucking off. Mental.
I didn't respond because I was just jealous. I was like, fuck you, man. It's freezing and wet here. Fuck yourself complaining about that. But equally, it's a bit worrying. It's only April.
27 degrees at the start of April. So anyway, so you're like stuck a tree basically in front of the windows trying to hope that will grow and give me a shade. Cause,
that will. They make the area cooler as well, don't they? Just trees, because they like, literally absorb heat out of the air.
Yeah.
Well, so something like that. I don't think that's the actual fucking science behind it.
No, I'm a tree engineer, and I can tell you that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Heat out the air.
Just going to drive to work in my tree-mobile.
Yeah, so that's been me. I've been digging holes and putting trees in.
What sort of tree then? Talk to me about the tree.
Cherry tree, like, you know, like the Japanese ones that don't produce cherries, they just make flowers.
The blossom, got, like, a cherry blossom.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you get them to blossom? Because it's like a beautiful thing, isn't it? When we were planning our Japan trip that we still haven't done, me and the waterfall, we were planning to, like, go and try and see that, because apparently it's beautiful to see.
Yeah, but it appears for, like, they're in blossom now. It's, like, 2 weeks in the spring, and that's it.
Mm.
So if you fuck up when you book your trip, then you
just... What are you going to do the rest of the year?
Oh, it's got leaves on it then.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. But yeah, it's got blossoms, you know, feeling inspired to cut your stomach out for short sword or possibly fire a bow.
The Japanese samurai.
Yeah, that's been me. How about you? What are you up to?
Not a fat lot, man. Been really busy with work. I've not really done anything interesting. I got some cool things, some boring things going on this weekend. Got a trip to IKEA, but I've also got a bottomless brunch planned as a baby shower that I'm going to. Which is going to be fun.
Is the shower made out of real babies?
Yeah.
Pointing from a blender.
I might grab a few while I'm there. But yeah, no, so I'm excited for that. So that's going to be good on Saturday. But then I've got to go IKEA on the day after, so I can't get too spannered.
That's always a serious test of the relationship.
Yeah, obviously there's going to be a lot of booze. Mm. It's like a pre-baby shower for an adoption, this is. So it's, you know, it's going to be a heavy one, I think.
Yeah, there's not actually a baby that's...
Around
potentially being horrifically alcohol damaged, so...
Exactly. No kids are there. Bunch of adults celebrating, basically, so we're going to get smashed.
Yeah, no, that's how you do it.
So yeah, I've had a good time at that. But yeah, not a lot, mate. Not a lot of fat interesting going on though. But there's something interesting going on next week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Ross is coming over next week. And we're going to have a good time, aren't we?
We're going to frolic, we're going to plait each other's hair, we're going to put ribbons.
If we're not too drunk, we're going to try and do a podcast in person, we said. But
yeah.
It just depends how hammered we get on the nights and how much effort we got in the days, basically. So no promises, we might get a little cheeky in first ever in-person special, We Are Makes History.
Yeah, I think we pencil that one in. It's in a
to-be. You know what I mean? Easy to rub out. It rubs
easily
out.
Rubbed out.
Yeah. Would be nice. But yeah, Sam, bruv, so it's a new one.
Hold on. What's your drink?
Oh shit, sorry, mate. What? Wow, you go first, please. You normally go first. That's the situation. I'm all lacking. I don't know what's going on, mate. Sorry, mate. I've lost the script, basically.
I think I need to find the new co-host. I'm mavericking it.
Yeah. I basically forgot what we're doing. Ross, what are you fucking supping on, brother?
I've got a Radagast.
I've had that before with you. Where did we have Radagast?
Possibly in the zoo.
Maybe.
It's like you see it in places a bit a lot.
Possibly to the English person.
Yeah, it's insane. The zoo,
there's no fucking booze. That's quite a weird concept. I'm only okay with it because I've done it. But it's probably the zoo. And everyone's like, why the fuck did you get Radagast from a zoo?
I realised that I've gone native. Like last time I came back in the summer. And it was a really hot day, and I was taking the kids out, and I was taking them to Twycross Zoo, which is a monkey specialised zoo. And me and the wife were both like, oh, because I'm going to get there.
When were you in Twycross Zoo?
Last summer.
Oh, okay. Or summer before.
Last summer, so anyway. And we're like, oh, yes, you know, travelling down. So, oh, yeah, I'd be glad to get a beer. Of course, you can't get a fucking beer in the zoo in England. What sort of psychopath are you?
Yeah. Fucking hell. Just walking around. That's great, that was just walking around with a beer. Beer and a hot dog. A good hot dog, it was good sausage. I remember that sausage. Oh, mate, yeah, it was good that was.
So, yeah, I mean, I would say this is like a not great beer, but the thing is, they have the most fucking ridiculous advertising. It's like trying so hard to be like manly and rugged, and like their current advertising is like a manly man chopping logs in the woods, then a wolf comes, then he gets a gun, fires it in the air and scares the wolf away while staring it down, and then he swings on his Radagast.
Oh, what a hero, what a Radagast hero. Fuck you, wolf, I got the firepower. Sells it, I'd have that. I'd buy that product now.
But like the gunshot is also really badly CGI'd in, like there's no recoil or anything, just like, goes flash. And the wolf is clearly a real wolf, and it's clearly like a tame, trained one, and someone's called it away because it goes like,
yeah.
And just walks off, like to go and get the food or whatever the fuck.
What can I hear, an aircraft?
Yeah, that is. I live next to a military airbase, and that is almost certainly what that is.
I've been recording for a while, you know now. I didn't realise that.
Yeah, normally you don't hear it. Like the fighter jets aren't normally based out of this one, but they come here every so often when the weather conditions are right here.
Oh, that's mad, that is. That's cool as fuck.
Yeah. I saw them flying around. It was like the L-39s, which are like the trainers. But sometimes they have the Gripen, which is like the, you know, the fighter jets. And when they go over, you just can't hear anything.
Wow. That's nice, man. That's cool.
And it'll be like sometimes when I'm at work and I'll be like, you know, on a call or whatever, and a Gripen goes over, it's just like, okay, I have to stop the call because I can't hear anything anybody's saying.
Yeah, I've never heard that before. Obviously, we don't talk a lot over the phone, well, over the internet. Never heard him that loud before. That's impressive, man. Like, that was something big, man. Oh, yeah.
So, right. So
I've got a bit of a weird concoction, to be honest, and you're probably going to judge me for it.
I see glass bottles moving around quite a lot.
I've got a bottle of, it's called Burning Barn Spice Rum. It's really nice spice rum. I popped it open last week when Mitch was around. No, I didn't, it was already open, but me and Mitch had a bit of it last week when he was around with a few of these. He liked it, obviously, you know he likes his spice rum, don't I? And I just fell in love with it, mate. It's pretty nice, really, his drink. Normally I have it with Coke, but I ain't got no Coke in the house. So I'm having it with Monster. And you know what? It's proper nice. It's covering eyes. I'm well stocked. I have Monster every day on the drive to work to keep me going.
Fine Caribbean aged rub, like, you know, passed down, yeah, handcrafted through the generations. Oh, Monster would improve this. No end.
It does sound good, man. It sounds like a real powerful Monster that I should probably have every morning on the way to work.
While I'm driving in.
I feel like performance will be increased. But it's a nice bottle as well. I know they can't eat you. They can't hear the bottle. You can't see the bottle. You can hear the bottle.
Yeah, it looks nice.
Ooh, but yeah, you can see it. It's very nice. It's got one of those little juggy handles as well on the side. So yeah, you can have like a hoedown with it, you know, put it over your arm. Look, yeah. Yeah. History. It's a history podcast. Mm. Probably talk about that. New history. It's a new history. It's a new season. Did we teaser it? I think we teasered it, didn't we? What we were doing?
We very slightly teasered it, I think.
It'll be the title anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry about it.
So, go on, Ross. Intro us in. What are we going to do? What are we talking about?
All right, so we are going to get medieval on your ass.
Oh, yeah. So, first time we touched it.
Yep. Both the ass and the medieval.
Both the mouth and the arse end. No, now maybe that's the title. What sort of medieval are we talking? Are we talking all of it?
We're going to do something very specific. We're going to talk about a country that emerged in the late Middle Ages called the Burgundian State, the Duchy of Burgundy.
And this was a country, wasn't it?
Sort of. It's very hard to classify exactly what it was.
I suppose it is, but by modern standards, it very much is from a lot of countries at this stage, because things are moving around, and they still...
Yeah, I mean, like, the idea of the state is still very fluid in this time, like, what is and what is not a country.
It's not as centralised as it is now.
No. And, like, the Burgundian state that emerges in the 14th and 15th century, it becomes the richest, most powerful country in Western Europe. It's like a flowering culture of fucking art and culture and incredible wealth.
A lot of people ain't heard of it.
Yeah, no one's ever heard of it, and it lasted like 100 years before it disappeared entirely.
Madness. Fucking mad, ain't it, that can happen?
Yeah. So it literally went from being top of the pile. Most people only
want to go like Burgundy, like the red wine. Like, that's what people are going to be saying. And obviously, I'm guessing the name comes from because that's one of the regions that Burgundy had.
Exactly, yeah.
Because the borders do shift around a lot in their existence, but there's like a general rough area, aren't they, where they're placed.
Yeah, so our starting point is, if you are vaguely familiar with France, is the Burgundy region of France, which is like on the east central side of France, kind of northwest of where Switzerland is.
And what are these guys? Where do they come from? Where's the idea come from?
Okay, so we're going to yada yada about 800 years, just to give the general concept of where this comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Burgundians, the very first Burgundian people, were originally a tribal group from the island of Bornholm, which is today in Denmark, and it's like an island in the Baltic. Okay. That name, Bornholm, was originally Burgunderholm.
Okay.
So this is kind of the mythological origins of the Burgundian people, right?
Is there any sort of real connection there?
There's some genetic evidence to suggest that yes, there is.
There may be very early on some people moved from that area.
Yeah.
So that gets diluted down very quickly, doesn't it?
Drastically
different area. Obviously, everybody else's gene pool is local, so it does get diluted down very quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I mean, like, we're talking here, like, back in the Roman Empire period, to begin with. And there's references in Roman texts about...
Sorry, man, I was coughing then. Can you say that again? Back in the when?
So back in, like, you know, the Roman Empire,
yeah,
there are references in the text to this group of Germanic people called the Burgundians who are kind of moving around. They pop up in what's modern Poland, and eventually they end up along the Rhine. So the River Rhine is like the frontier of the Western Roman Empire, right? On one side...
So put into context as well, we still had at this point like mass migrations of people, didn't we?
Getting to that.
Okay.
Getting to that. Hold on. So like in the 3rd century AD, which is kind of height of the Roman Empire sort of period, the Burgundians rock up and they appear along the Rhine. So on the left side of the Rhine, you have like Roman Gaul, which is like modern France and Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side is like the Germanic speaking barbarians.
Yeah.
And exactly like you say, with the dilution of the ethnicity, like we should, although like films and TV always shows like barbarian tribe as like everybody belongs to this group.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like ethnically pure, that's not how it was. Like there would be all sorts of outcasts and people from different groups and people who have left Roman society. And basically, they're just following a leader.
Yeah.
Like, there'll be people following the king of the Burgundians, but that doesn't mean that they're, like, ethnic pure from Denmark.
Yeah, they're not from a location, they're from a leader. Like, they belong to the leader, not the area, because that leader could take them places.
Yeah, it's a bit like, I don't know, like a modern American citizenship. Like, the idea that you can be from anywhere, but you can become an American. It's a bit like that. Mm-hmm. Like, you, if you follow the leader, you're a Burgundian.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Burgundians are very good at kind of playing off the different power factions in the Roman Empire and being useful to different players at different times. And they get their own kind of recognised kingdom. And they get settled in eastern Gaul, so in the eastern part of France, along the River Rhine. Basically, the Romans are giving out land in exchange for military service.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to play off these different factions, and they're able to do pretty well for themselves. The kingdom kind of moves around a bit. Its borders change. Sometimes it's further south, down towards Italy. Other times further north in, like, Strasbourg sort of region. But generally speaking, up and down that sort of area, from the north to the south of modern-day Switzerland.
Okay.
By the late Roman Empire, there's other Germanic barbarian people coming into the empire, like the Franks and the Angles and the Saxons and the Visigoths, and the Burgundians are one of these groups who come in and they're able to carve out their kingdom.
Just put that into perspective as well. Didn't the Visigoths say and just been like Spain, didn't they?
They
like,
did, that's end up in where Spain.
Yeah, a lot of Spanish heritage comes from the Visigoths.
Yeah.
Which is madness. Like you're talking at this point, they're in Germany.
It's
very strange moves, isn't it? Not like modern, like how we think of like ethnicity mm-hmm, and culture mm-hmm. nowadays. We think about a location rather than a people.
Yeah. Like the Vandals, who were also Germanic people, would end up in North Africa. Like it's a crazy time of movement in the 5th century AD.
Yeah.
Anyway, so like the Burgundians set up their kingdom, but the other powers around them are much stronger. The Visigoths in particular we mentioned, and also the Franks. They are much stronger. The Burgundians can't really keep up with them on a kind of power level. So again, they have to keep this kind of dance of playing off different groups.
They have to be diplomatic. They have to sort of be... They can't win militarily and economically, so they just have to win the diplomatic battle, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. And as part of this, the Burgundian king named Gundobad marries his daughter Clotilda to the Frankish king, Clovis.
Clotilda,
which is a beautiful Burgundian name.
Wow, I've not heard that one before.
So he marries his daughter to the king of the Franks. And what's important is the Franks at this point are still pagans, like Germanic pagans, like Woden and Forth and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But the Burgundians are Christian and Catholic specifically.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so they're like way close to the French, yeah?
Keep the idea of the French.
Okay.
They're closer to the Western Romans.
Yeah, because they're Catholic at this point, aren't they?
Yeah. So, King Clovis of the Franks is pagan, but his wife, Clotilda, is Christian. And Clotilda insists on baptising their children, which has the like hilarious unintended side of it that they keep dying, because like, they're little tiny babies, and like baptism in them days wasn't like a little sprinkle on the forehead and some photos.
Drowning,
it was like
mate.
Fucking dunking them in, and they kept like getting cold and dying afterwards.
Oh wow!
So they lost several children because they did this.
It's a baptism.
Yeah, and
talk
like
about baptism by fire.
Yeah, exactly. And like Clovis is like explicitly blaming his wife that she keeps killing their children.
Fucking hell! It's gonna put a strain on your relationship, aren't it?
Well, apparently, like, Clotilda must have been an absolute fox or something, because Clovis eventually converts to Catholicism with her.
Oh, maybe he just saw the light through all the dead babies.
I see the will of the Lord over this pile of dead babies.
Maybe.
So, Clovis converts to Catholicism, and he takes the Franks with him. the Franks gradually becoming stronger and stronger, and Burgundy ends up being, like, integrated into their kingdom. Like, they could no longer resist, and they became, mm-hmm. like, a subject to the Franks.
And then their name disappears for a little bit.
Yeah, so it becomes just, like, one title among many, kind of. And the Franks become, you know, over their long history, they go sometimes stronger, sometimes weaker, sometimes divided, sometimes united. At their height, under Emperor Charlemagne, they rule all the way from the French Atlantic coast east to what is now Austria.
Hang on, let me just imagine that. French Atlantic coast?
Yeah, like the west coast of France, all the way to Austria. Oh, wow. All as one thing.
Really? Under what was this?
Under the 9th century. 8th and 9th century.
Fuck, really? That's cool. Didn't know that.
Yeah. Charlemagne came as close as anyone to rebuilding the Western Roman Empire.
That'd be an interesting one, out of how that fell apart.
We'll touch on that a little bit. So, after Charlemagne dies, his son also dies, and the Franks have an inheritance where they split the land between the sons, right?
Yeah.
Anyone who's played Crusader Kings knows that this sort of like fucks up the early game.
Yeah, big time.
And they end up splitting the empire into three parts. West Francia, which will become the Kingdom of France. East Francia, which will become the King, like Germany. And also Middle Francia in the middle, which will basically go from down from what is now the Netherlands and Belgium through this kind of Rhine area all the way down to the Italian coast.
To be fair, geographically, a nice plot of land that is, to be fair. Access to both coasts, a lot of minerals and resources.
But there's no, like, there's no cultural cohesion. There's no obvious centre.
No.
But I think that's interesting because this idea of a country in between France and Germany keeps coming up. You know, it just keeps popping there. A country tries to be there a few times. Yeah. Anyway, so the heirs of Charlemagne fight amongst themselves. And the important part is the old kingdom of Burgundy ends up split in two parts. The majority of it ends up in what becomes West Francia or France, which is the Duchy of Burgundy.
So that's like Aquitaine area.
No. Aquitaine is down in the southwest. It's like close to Spain.
West?
West in the centre. Like West Francia becomes modern France. Oh, Burgundy is like roughly split through the middle. So the western half becomes the Duchy of Burgundy. The eastern half becomes the County of Burgundy, also known as the Franche-Comte. Okay. It's still called that today. It means the Free County. So importantly, like the Burgundian realm is split in half between these two kingdoms, but the idea of Burgundy still exists. We're going to get back to this. This is going to be important later. But the idea is these two different halves of the kingdom end up in different realms.
Mm-hmm.
By the 10th century, there is a new family taken over from the family of Charlemagne, which are called the Capets, who become the kings of France.
Mm-hmm.
And the Duchy of Burgundy, so the half of Burgundy.
Where do I know that name from? Capet? What game?
Crusader Kings.
Is it?
Definitely Crusader Kings. Okay. The Capets end up ruling France for a good 300 years, and they're going to be important for the story we're telling.
Okay.
The Duchy of Burgundy ends up owned by like a junior branch of the Capet dynasty. So like a younger son inherits Burgundy, the main like line, other kings of France.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is the backstory is now complete. So thank you for listening for that 500-year yada yada.
Well done, mate. Fair play. It's important, though. It's cool to know.
Yeah, it lays it down.
I know that's the inspiration for the story, ain't it? That's the inspiration.
Yeah.
So by the time this country forms, it's actually got no fucking link to what's just happened, apart from geographic, has it?
Yeah, so that's important to clarify. It's like the Burgundian people, as in those German barbarians, are by this point heavily mixed with the Latin-speaking, you know, Gallic and Roman population. And by the 10th century, you couldn't tell that, like, this German element had ever existed. They're speaking the form of Latin that has become French, and there's basically Italian nothing of that. Yeah, and Occitan, which is an important language in that time.
Oh, okay. It's
spoken in southern France.
Yeah.
It's
still spoken as well, isn't it?
It is. It's on the edge of extinction. Yeah. But well into the 19th century, it was the majority language for a lot of France.
Oh, no, it's okay.
Anyway, so we're going to fast forward a bit into the high Middle Ages. So we're talking like our story begins in the 14th century. One of the things we need to establish is the idea of feudalism. So, Foz, what do you know about feudalism?
Kings, castles, king rules everything, he's the boss man, his son inherits.
Mm-hmm.
You have, like, dukes, so the king rules everything, and then under him, so, like, as England as an example, you'd have maybe Duke of Wessex, mm-hmm. and geographically that's, like, maybe an eighth of the country, and then, like, a duke for, you know, York. You know, and then you split the country up, and those dukes have their own levies and vassals, and under those have counts. Counts own castles. Count lives in his castle. And he has, like, a levy, and he has men, and he has a bit of land and that, and it's like a hierarchical structure.
Yeah, pretty much. So, yeah, it's like a hierarchy and also, like, a franchise system. So the king sits on the top of the pile, like you say. Different levels of nobility, though it's not quite so much like this pyramid. I know you have this idea of the pyramid structure because you see it in the school textbooks and stuff, but it's not quite as rigid as that. Like, the king can have dukes or earls or counts, whoever answering to him. It can be different levels can be answering. Okay. But this idea, broadly correct, different levels of nobility. And it's basically like the king franchises out the land to his lords, they franchise it out to the barons, they have a castle they live in, hold it down.
I also think there's a baron and a count.
Baron has less shit.
Oh, okay, but similar sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, counts don't exist in the English system. We have earl, but it's...
Oh, what's a count, then?
It's in the French system, but it's earl and count.
And definitely in Transylvania, because obviously there's the count from...
Exactly. Everyone that lives in Transylvania is a count.
You know what he loves to do?
Does he love to count?
He does, yeah. Fucking does, mate. You never would have guessed that, but yeah. Fucking loves it. He's mad for counting. Come on, please. Sorry, Sesame Street.
So, yeah, so you have this structure. So you have peasants at the bottom who are essentially property, levels going up. One thing that, like, you know, there's the classic kind of school book diagram. One thing that doesn't capture is that there's two pyramids. One of, like, secular society, kings, lords, and one of religious society, like priests, bishops, etc.
Yeah.
The church exists completely outside the control of the king.
They're untouchable as well, sort of, to a sort of level, aren't they?
Yeah, they have their own law courts. Like, if a priest commits a crime, he's tried in a church court, not by the king.
Yeah, yeah. That's why they got away with it so much.
So, yeah, so there's all these, like, the lands divide up in these different titles. Very important concept to understand, which is going to be really important for us in this series. You can hold multiple titles. It doesn't mean the titles, like, merge.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the different titles, you hold them in their own right. So it's a bit like you as a person are the King of England, let's say. You are also the Duke of Normandy. Those are two separate legal entities. Yeah.
So there's still, like, a King of France. So you would be a duke to him.
Yes.
But also a duke that has a kingdom of his own.
Yeah, and it's a bit like, you know, it's almost like in a corporate structure when someone has multiple jobs, they're like, oh, when I'm speaking as head of procurement or when I'm speaking as head of finance, it's that sort of thing. Like, yeah. It's like the same person as multiple people because they hold these titles in their own right, yeah. Which is important to understand. So, for us, this is important to understand because our dukes that we're going to talk about end up holding a lot of different titles, and it's important to understand that that doesn't mean they merge with their primary title of Dukes of Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
Mentioned the Duke of Normandy, King of England example, because this is a good example of it. The Dukes of Normandy, after the Norman Conquest in 1066, become Kings of England, which means, exactly as you say, they are still French dukes as well as being English kings, and they have to serve the French king in their capacity as a French duke, but not in their capacity as the English king.
Yeah. So you all, like, know what them French dukes are like. La-dee-da.
But it's like, the theoretically and, like, at times in practice, the King of England would have to go to England, to France, pledge his fealty to the King of France, but they would also explicitly stay in his position as the Duke of Normandy, not in his position as King of England.
Yeah. I guess that must have been a bit rough for him, knowing, like, I'm a king and I'm having to bend a knee to him.
I'm just gonna, this is a little bit foreshadowing, because this is going to be a problem for approximately 2/3 of this episode.
I didn't mean for anything, but I'd be pissed off. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm king of like Fozland over here, having a great fuzzy time about things. And then I've got a bit of your shit. Like, your stuff.
Yeah, you got my shit. Come on. Respect me, because you got some of my shit.
And then I have to respect you. I'm like, no, I've got your shit.
It's my shit.
No, but it's my shit. I've got
it. It's my shit.
But you're not listening to me, Ross. I'm a king. I know you're a king, but I'm a king. I've got some of your shit. I've got
look at this, Ryan.
I couldn't give a fuck about what you've got over there. Maybe this is more about the French. Maybe this is more about the French.
Yeah, this is literally how the Hundred Years War.
Yeah, no, I've got your shit. Thank you, France. I've got your shit. That's literally, we fought fucking a war, a 100-year war.
Two-thirds of this episode is going to be about exactly this.
Oh, really? That was fucking, I wasn't even planned. I ain't got the script up, man.
I love the fact that you don't read the script, because then these things happen and they're super spontaneous.
Carry on, please, bruv.
All right, so let's bring it into where we've got to really start the story. And we're going to start in the 14th century, so that's 1300. Europe is... in what is known as the High Middle Ages, like the 12th, 13th century, and like most of the medieval stuff you think of as medieval is when this happens. And it's kind of a bit of a high point for European culture, coming out of like, you know, Dark Ages and kind of the chaotic period after the end of the Roman Empire. By the 12th century, people are talking in terms of a Renaissance. There's a lot going on. There's Latin translations of the old Greek and Roman texts. This is when all like the monasteries really reach their peak, when a lot of universities are created.
The importance of converting the text as well for people who don't read, because I don't think that's quite obvious to a lot of people what that means. Like, go remember, at this point of time, most people couldn't read the Bible, because it was always in Latin. Yeah. And the educated wealth people all spoke Latin. The regular people didn't, so they didn't actually know what the Bible said. They were just told what it was said by his religious leaders. So converting the Bible is a big fucking deal.
But it's not just the Bible. It's also like, so I should give more context. Like, you think of like, you know, your Greek philosophers, your Roman scientists, whatever. Their works had been lost in Western Europe. They were still preserved in Arabic and Greek, but now they're entering Western Europe.
Yeah, because they've been converted.
They're available to scholars. And we have all these new universities and monasteries for people sitting around studying these texts.
Yeah.
This is also the time when, like, you know, most of your medieval cathedrals are built. So, like, your Notre Dame of Paris, your Westminster Abbey, this is when they're built.
And this is why it's called a Renaissance period. Because it's like a reimagining of an old historical...
Yeah, a rebirth. Literally means rebirth.
Yeah.
And we have technology development going on. So we have the first windmills, the first, like, eyeglasses... the magnetic compass invented, new types of ship.
The power press. That was a bit later on, but that was invented. That was invented in like, I think
it was power press.
1500 or something.
Really?
Yeah, 1500. It's on the historical age on the EU4. No,
I didn't know that.
Oh, it's a little bit later.
That's the printing pressure.
Yeah, but it's the same time. It's the same mechanism. Exactly the same mechanism.
Okay, I didn't know.
Yeah.
So, 12th and 13th centuries, a lot going on. It's also a time when, like, it's a time of a warm climate, so more land becomes ploughable, which means population can grow. There's new farming technologies, better ploughs, better field systems, more food equals more people. Then you can start clearing forests because you have the labour, which means even more land means even more people.
It's a boom period for Europe.
In terms of the political situation, so this is on the back end of the Crusades. By this point, the Crusades to the Middle East aiming to conquer the Holy Land have failed. But there are still Crusades going on in the Baltic, which are in the process of conquering the last remaining pagans in Europe, the Lithuanians and Latvians and others. So there's this colonization effort going into the forests, cutting down the forests, building up these port and trading cities. There's a huge complex trade system coming out of the Baltic into Western Europe. The Italian city-states are all heading towards the Renaissance. Like, the Italian language is being standardized. you know, this artistic production of Italian, of these hugely wealthy city states is coming online, increasingly rich and sophisticated culture. Down in Spain, Spain has been conquered mostly by North African Islamic people. At this point, the Christians who have kind of survived on the northern edge of Spain are going on to the offensive, and they're beginning the Reconquista, the reconquest of Spain by the Christians.
The Pope was involved big time in that as well, wasn't it?
The Pope is at pretty much the height of his power of any period. Like, yeah. The Pope's word matters hugely. We mentioned before about, like, you know, the ability to read the Bible and stuff. At this point, the Pope's supremacy in Western Europe is unchallenged. Mm-hmm. There is heresy movements, like the Cathars, for instance, in southern France, but we're not at the stage of, like, the Hussites or the Protestants yet.
Okay.
To kind of finish our, like, you know, our geographical tour, the English kings by the 12th century have become the rulers of big chunks of western, northern and southern France. Like, they rule more of France than the French king does.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout
that,
the 12th...
Was that Henry?
We start off with William the Conqueror, obviously, with Normandy, and Henry the First.
Yeah, Henry the First goes and just fucking gets stomping.
He doesn't go stomping. He marries a woman called Eleanor of Aquitaine, who was basically the French king's wife who left him and ran off and married the...
I'm thinking of the Battle of Henry the Fourth.
Henry
the
Fifth. Hold on to that.
Okay.
Hold on to that. Henry the First marries Eleanor of Aquitaine. She inherits this, the Duchy of Aquitaine, which is fucking huge. The entire western coast of France.
He just gets it.
He just gets it through marriage. And she was married to the French king and she fucked off and ran off to England and married the English king.
Or the man who would become the
king. Yeah.
Nice.
Over the course of the 13th century...
That was during the Crusades, wasn't it?
Yeah, this is Richard the Lionheart.
Yeah,
this was...
He was in the Crusades, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Lionheart was on the Crusades and his brother...
King John, who, as we all know, was a lion that sucked his thumb and had bad times with a fox.
Yeah.
As we saw in the documentary.
Robin Hood.
Can you tell that I have children?
Yeah.
So during the 13th century, the English kings, or say English, they did not speak English, they spoke French, they ruled from France. They were mm-hmm. French lords who happened to own an English kingdom. This is also an important thing to understand at this point. Like, the idea of, like, an English and French king in that national sense does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, by the 13th century, the English king had lost most of those lands, apart from the southwest, the Duchy of Aquitaine. So, like, Normandy and Anjou, the ancestral lands of the king, were gone.
Cool.
Anyway, so let's roll it forward to the 14th century, which is when we need to start thinking about. At the start of the century, in the year 1314, the French king from the House of Capet, Philip the Fair, dies. Now... You've played Crusader Kings, everyone's favourite medieval dynasty and child murder simulator.
Yeah, got a game.
Philip the Fair leaves behind 3 sons and a daughter. If you are a king, how are you feeling about your succession?
Well, if you're playing it like Crusader Kings, you want one kid to inherit everything for the power.
Bear in mind, for the audience that don't know Crusader Kings, the lose condition in Crusader Kings is running out of people to inherit your power.
Mm.
So you've got 3 sons and a daughter. I think you're feeling pretty confident. So, he's inherited by his oldest son, Louis the X, known as the Quarrelsome. So apparently he was a bit of a prick. Notably, and this is a fantastic little detail, Louis the X invented indoor tennis courts.
Nice.
Loved tennis, didn't want to stop his training. Fucking loves tennis.
Fair play to him.
After a particularly exhausting game of tennis, he drank loads of cooled wine and died of pneumonia at the age of 26.
Okay. There was more to that story than met the eye then, I guess.
Yeah, there's suspicion about this, and you're going to see why there's suspicion in the next couple of sentences. So, at the point Louis X dies, very unexpectedly at the age of 26, he had no children, but his wife was pregnant, right? And everyone agrees, okay, we're going to wait till the baby is born. If it's a boy, it will be king. If it's a girl, then we go to the brother. Everyone agreed that a girl couldn't hold a title. Uh-huh. You couldn't have a ruling queen. His wife was pregnant, she gave birth, and a boy was born. Yay. Boy died 4 days later.
Oh, no.
Remarkably convenient for some people.
Mm. So there's his brother.
Yeah, so his older brother, Philip the Tall, the second son of the former king.
How tall was he?
Pretty tall. I think you have to be pretty tall if you're known as Philip the Tall. Like, yeah. Fuck me, you're tall.
Yeah. Back in here, airplanes again.
Yeah, I think I'm being bombed.
What's that? Can you see it?
Can't see it. Sounds like propeller engine, so like,
yeah, it does, to be fair, it does. That's pretty cool.
That's fairly likely to be a cargo plane on its way to Poland.
If we were a professional podcast, we'd edit all that out, but I don't know how to do that, so.
I think it adds character.
Yeah, it adds character, but it's weird, isn't it? You know what I mean? We just keep it real back here. That's all we do.
So anyway, so his brother Philip the Tall becomes King Philip the Fifth. Philip the Fifth is King of France for 6 years until he catches dysentery.
Oh, good.
Yeah, dysentery just makes you basically shit yourself to death.
Yeah, that's a bad time to go, ain't it?
So he shits himself to death at the age of 30.
Oh, well done, mate.
So Philip had 4 kids, presumably also all very tall, but all of them are daughters, no sons. As we say,
too women much pooping, man. Couldn't too much some, pooping.
Yeah, he just pooped out the sun jeans. Mm. So women couldn't hold titles or lands in their own right. Mm. So he's out of the succession, and the throne goes to the third brother. This is Charles the Fair, who becomes Charles the Fourth of France.
He's got an awesome name.
Yeah, the fair, I mean, like, you know, there's a lot of ways you could take that. All of them are good. Mm. He lasts for 6 years, also keels over, also only has daughters, no male claimants left in the direct line from the former king.
Okay, so things get messy then.
Yeah, so they've burned through, like, 4 kings in 16 years. So, now there is the question of who inherits the throne. Now, the former king, what's his name, Philip the Fair, 3 sons and a daughter, right? The daughter, Isabella, is still alive. She has a son. Problem solved, right? The problem is that she's married to Edward II, King of England, and her son is going to be the King of England. This would mean the King of England inherits the Kingdom of France. Therefore, the University of Paris and the top legal scholars in France come together and they have a big conference where they decide that no, Isabella couldn't possibly pass on the inheritance because, they argue, she is a woman, which means she can't inherit in her own right, so therefore her son can't inherit through her.
Okay.
This overturns basically all of the established and agreed rules of inheritance.
No, never changing the rules.
Yeah, because they didn't want to be inherited by the King of England, and that's what it is. So they come up with this rule to remove Edward III from the throne, from the line of succession, and what they have to do then is go back up the Capet family tree, go to a previous king who had a brother, follow the brother's family down until they find a son, and they do this, and they come up with the younger brother of the previous king, and they get to a guy named Philip, who is the Count of Valois, and he becomes King Philip the Sixth, the first king of a new dynasty, the Valois.
I know that name.
Yeah. Edward III, now King of England, calls bullshit and invades France in 1337, pressing his claim on the throne of France.
And he was only a kid at this point, wasn't
he? Yeah, he was like a early 20s.
Yeah.
Like, he's about 25 years old, I think, at this point. He was about 15, 16 when the French legal scholars decided that he couldn't be king of France.
And he was like, nah, fuck you, I'm invading.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which he was good at, to be fair. He was tactically sound, wasn't he? He
is. Some historians have argued that he is the greatest English general that ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
So the first years of the war are pretty ineffective. Like, there's some limited English raiding across the sea into northern France, and also remember Aquitaine down the southwest is part of England. There's some victories on a small to medium scale over the French in the south. The way that the English fight, though, is they use a technique called the chevauchée. And basically what this is an army goes into an area, spreads out, and like just loots and pillages and raids and destroys everything. So basically the idea is to put like economic attrition onto the enemy. You can have your big army, you can be sitting in your castle, fine, we're going to burn down every village around. How long can you let us do this before you come and fight us?
That's pretty brutal, isn't it?
Extremely fucking brutal. Like we should be under no illusions of what this involved. Like, the army rolls into a village, it's like nothing but rape, murder, and pillage while they're there. So, this goes on for a few years, this kind of low-level to medium-level raiding. In the year 1346, so 9 years into the war, they launch a full-on invasion. The English launch a full-on invasion of France, led by the king himself. So they land in northern France, they're rocking around, they're burning shit, doing the chevauchée. Philip, king of France, Philip VI, challenges Edward to like an honourable battle. Like he sends him like an invitation to a place and a time to come and fight. Edward gives like an indication, yeah, I'll come down and meet you. What he actually does is burn the town down that he's in and go the other way.
Fair play.
The French have the advantage in numbers. There's 20 to 30,000 men in the army that Philip assembles against between 7 and 15,000 English.
Okay.
So we're talking 2 to 3 to 1 outnumbered. The French army begins chasing the English. So the English are now having to run through this hostile landscape that they have burned down.
Yeah.
They have no food. They're struggling with disease because hanging out with 10,000 of your mates in the countryside in the Middle Ages is not a fantastic idea.
No, it's not good for the old chest and lungs, is it?
No, it's not good for the old not shitting yourself to death.
Yeah, serious fucking shitting.
Anyway, so the French army chases the English down and eventually they catch up with them at a place called Crecy on the 26th of August 1346. So the English are trapped. They're massively outnumbered. The English form up on a hillside. Their knights get off of their horses. They're going to fight on foot. Importantly, 50% of this army is made up of longbowmen. So these are archers using a particular type of bow which is specific to England and Wales. Wales.
It's from Wales, but obviously that was adopted.
It was adopted, by this
point, wasn't it?
So, exactly.
I think it was a big part of like, the advantage that they had sometimes, wasn't it? Like that sort of thing. There wasn't many bows in the world at that point that were like the longbow, I don't think.
Yeah, it's more sophisticated in what it can do. And I think also, I mean, I was trying to look into this, I didn't get a really clear sense, but I think this is one of the first times the French are on the receiving end of large numbers of bowmen.
Okay.
Like, the English have fought the French before, but these have been more like French civil wars. The two armies have been very similar.
Yeah.
This is after the English conquest of Wales, and things have changed a bit now.
Okay.
So the English form up on the hillside, and the French advance to them, confident in their numbers. The first wave of the French advance is made up of mercenary Italian crossbowmen, the best crossbowmen in the business.
Yeah, they're well known at this point, weren't they? The Italian crossbowmen mercenaries.
Yeah.
Well equipped, well funded.
Exactly. Very powerful, big, heavy crossbows, and the way they fought.
A lot of veterancy as well, because obviously your crossbowmen are the last people to die in army. So obviously bowmen.
Yeah.
You get a lot of veterancy there because they survive most of fights because they're not in the melee fucking chopping at each other.
And as you know, they're in high demand across Europe as the best of the best.
Yeah.
So the way they normally fight is they move up with these big shields called pavises, which they hide behind. It takes away the disadvantage of the crossbows, the slow reload, because they can hide behind this massive shield they put in front on the ground in front of them, pop up over the shield, take the shot, drop back down, reload. The thing is, the French king is so eager to get to battle, he hasn't allowed the crossbowmen to get their shields out of the baggage train. So they go up just with their crossbows. They had nothing to hide behind. The second problem. Yeah, the second problem is as they're going up, a sudden rainstorm comes out. And the crossbows get soaked with rain. the strings become wet and, you know, loose and floppy, the English archers can just unstring their bows and then easily restring them.
Mm.
So they're coming up, they're going against an enemy that's on a hilltop, they don't have their shields, and their weapons are now wet and not ineffective. Doesn't go well for the Italian crossbowmen. They're outranged and outshot by the English archers.
There's a big range difference between a crossbow. And the crossbow is very accurate in shorter ranges, but the longbows have ridiculous range.
Honestly, in ideal conditions, the crossbow range is basically as good.
Really?
Yeah, it's just because the French keep... We have this perception because the French keep doing stupid shit with their crossbowmen, which is why we perceive it this way.
Oh, okay.
If the French weren't fucking incompetent throughout the Middle Ages, we wouldn't have this perception.
Yeah, okay.
So basically, the French take away all of the advantages of their crossbow and just, like, okay, off you go. And they're like, eh, mister, our crossbows are wet, we have no shields. And they're like, yeah. Oh, fuck off you go.
Yeah.
They get shot to pieces. Obviously, the big advantage of the longbow, it shoots much faster.
Mm.
You know, crossbowman has to get down, wind his bow with a machine because it's so powerful. He can't pull it by hand, whereas the longbowman is just pulling with his arm. It's much faster rate of fire.
They are hard to pull though, longbows. Especially
It takes some doing. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
You get your back muscles involved. You sort of have to start. I've seen the technique.
It takes years to train. Yeah,
to try and do a longbow.
But a crossbow, you need to like put on this winch and like, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Pound.
Oh yeah, it takes far longer.
So they've lost all of the things that make them effective. They get shot to pieces by the longbowmen, and the French knights are kind of looking down on these Italian, you know, commoners. So the French knights launch charge through their own crossbowmen. Okay. And they're like, start hacking down and cutting down their own crossbowmen.
Why would they do that? Surely they know that the crossbowmen are there.
Yeah, they know. They're just like cutting them out of the way, because how dare these fucking Italian commoners be in the way? Wow. Obviously, this is not good if you're trying to all launch like an organised charge if you fucking start fighting something halfway through the charge.
Yeah.
So the French knights get all fucking disordered by this, and then they come into longbow range and they start receiving the arrows. The arrows are not great against the armour, but the thing that isn't armoured is the big fucking thing that the knight is riding on, the horse.
Well, do they not have armour for the horses?
Not at this point.
Wow.
Not effective armour at this point.
So everything dropped.
All of the horses start going down.
It's a massive target.
Big target. And you imagine, okay, you're in the third row. The horse in front of you goes down. Where's your horse going?
Yeah.
Straight into the horse. Or the horse
gets in the butt. It's going
to
go off course, run into the other horses. The whole thing is just collapses in the whole
track. Exactly. It's like a cascade and effect down as each row comes into the line of fire. So the horses are tripping over each other. The riders are being crushed. But, you know, the knight goes down, his own comrades ride over the top of him. And it's a fucking bloodbath. The French nobility is devastated. Most of, like, the existing nobles and knights are killed. Czech side note, the King of Bohemia is fighting as an ally of the King of France. The King of Bohemia is Blind King John. Notable thing about that being blind.
Oh.
So... he's on his horse and he ties his horse to four of his knights and his knights lead him towards where the battle is.
What happens when he gets to the battle?
He fucking dies.
I feel like he leading a blind man to his death there a little bit, isn't it? Come on, King, let's get to the battle. But of course,
his Labrador gets the first arrow.
Yeah.
So in this fucking one day of slaughter, between 2,000 and 4,000 French knights are killed.
Oh man, bothers.
Nobody knows how many of the ordinary men and commoners are killed because no one bothers to count them because they don't matter, of course.
Yeah. Oh wow, it's a massacre this time of the world as well.
Yeah. So an army
of battles and stuff was just a couple hundred men rocking around. Yeah, exactly. Huge.
There's an army of 20,000 to 30,000, so we know 2,000 to 4,000 of the elite were killed, unknown thousands of the commoners. What do you reckon the English losses were?
Fucking hell. They've got to be in thousands, haven't
they? About 200.
How?
Just because the French don't even get close. They're just shot to pieces. They're
just shot, basically. Just, oh, what a way to go. Loads of fucking arrows pouring into your body. Ugh.
And then your horse goes down, and then your fucking mate Pierre rides over your head with his horse.
Yeah. And then an arrow goes through your arm.
Not a good time. So, yeah, this is a catastrophe for the French.
I bet that's proper sets them back.
Yeah. So the French kind of have a bad couple of years. So 3 years later, 1349, Philip VI also keels over and dies. And he's succeeded by his son, John II, known as the Good, Le Bon.
Ooh.
Our more history-attuned listeners will notice 1349 is a significant year, which is the year that the Black Death reaches Western Europe.
Mm.
Plague rips through Western Europe. One third of the population of the continent is killed.
Wow.
In southern England, that reaches 40%.
Really? Fuck, man. It's
fucking devastating. Entire villages disappear. In terms of all this chaos going on, so the French leadership has been decimated, their military has been taken out, and now this fucking apocalypse from God is ripping through the land. There is a peace treaty agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Black Death is pretty fucking horrifying. When you catch the Black Death, you get... First, your symptom is a fever of 40 degrees, right? You have some headaches, you're vomiting. Then you get, in the next couple of days, lumps appearing, growing in your groin and your armpits. And these lumps can be as big as an apple.
Ooh.
In the couple of days after that, you have like bright black spots appearing on your skin. Your fingertips... yeah, pretty much. Your fingertips die and the skin turns black. And basically your internal organs just die and liquefy and you start vomiting out blood.
Oh,
after which you're dead. Oh, 80% shit. Of people that catch it die within 8 days.
Wow.
So this is like the fucking apocalypse come down. And this is the context going on throughout the rest of this series. Like, just fucking vomity black blood death syndrome.
Happening. Imagine that going on.
Just everywhere. You know, like people, like, you know, walking between the villages, whipping themselves, praying for God's forgiveness. Fucking literally apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Like,
all while these dukes are trying to sort out who owns what.
Exactly. Like, all that foreshadowing about how, like, great things were in the 13th century, most of Europe's population doesn't recover to 13th century levels until the 19th century.
Wow.
So, there's an uneasy peace settles between the kings of England and the king of France. There's some low-scale raiding going on, and over the years, there's kind of rising tension as the plague dies down a bit. Mm-hmm. And especially English raiding out of Aquitaine down in the southwest is like big business. People are making a lot of money by raiding French villages, stealing everything.
Okay.
Increasingly, the French have to do something about this because it's, again, you just can't imagine like you're in your country and just like casually accepting, okay, villages are being burned down, everything's being stolen, fucking.
Yeah.
It can't endure. So by 1355, war is back on the cards, like 6 years after the war settled down previous time.
Mm-hmm.
Down in Aquitaine, the Prince of Wales, Edward the Black Prince, son of the king, is there leading an army. And in 1355, he goes on a massive raid along the Mediterranean coast of France, like into Provence and all of this sort of area, like, you know, Toulouse. And
where's he getting the name Black Prince from?
It's probably a 19th century invention, I think. Like, okay. There's a story it comes from his black armour, but it's like, it's probably a later nickname. In his lifetime, he was known as Edward of Woodstock.
Okay.
But anyway, so he's the oldest son of Edward III. 1356, he's doing the same shit again. Another year has been massively successful with this deep raid into French territory, fucking everything up, like causing serious economic harm to like the French heartlands. Gonna do it again. So John II, our new King of France, Jean II, if we prefer to be more en français, raises an army, about 15,000 men. So it's on a smaller scale than Crecy, which we kind of expect given that all of the fucking nobles were killed 10 years earlier.
Well, yeah, everyone's already dead, aren't they? So.
But he outnumbers the Black Prince's army about 3-1.
Yeah.
Gene is very confident of victory, and he takes his three...
Can't take him serious when you call him Gene, mate.
Let's call him John, sorry.
Yeah, because when you say Gene, I think of fucking her from X-Men. That's what I think about. Gene. The Rogue. The Phoenix.
I've got no idea. No? Superheroes, no?
Oh, okay, sorry.
Not my bag.
That's what I think about, anyway. Sorry, I took you off there.
John II raises up about 15,000 men, and he's so confident in victory, he takes his four sons with him. Because apparently he's been a busy man. So he's got four sons. Charles, Louis, John, and Philip. All of them go with him, because he's confident in victory, and he's like, okay, let's get some prestige for the boys, mm-hmm. they can be part of the great victory. Unlike at Crecy, where you had like all these thousands and thousands of like peasant levies, this army travels fully mounted on horses. Every man has
a horse. It's French armour.
Yes.
Fucking hell, well equipped, man.
Not everyone is a knight, but a very significant chunk of them are.
Wow, okay.
Out of this 15,000, 12 to 14,000 are knights or men-at-arms.
Cool, okay.
So it's a very heavy, heavily armoured, mounted force. They move much faster than the English can anticipate, because they expect it to be the normal French army that's moving at the speed of, like, peasant walking.
Yeah.
And John is able to catch Edward the Black Prince. And on the 19th of September, 1356, the two armies meet in western France at a place called Poitiers. Two of them kind of face off for about 2 hours. The English are again on a hillside, the French down on the lower ground. The French are stupid. They knew what happened last time.
Yeah.
So there's this big standoff, just 2 hours, the two armies facing each other down. The English begin moving their supply wagons towards the rear to clear them out of the way right for the fighting. King John, on his side, sees the movement of English forces towards the back. He doesn't know what's happening. He thinks the English are retreating. So he orders an attack. The English, again, are on foot, and they're defending the hillside, and there is, importantly, a big, thick hedgerow halfway down this hill. The biggest gap in this hedge is only big enough for four horses to come through at a time.
Okay.
So the English are behind this hedge, they're waiting there for the French.
They're hidden in the hedge between the two lines.
Yeah, pretty much.
Cool.
So the French come up to this hedge, they're not able to get through it, and obviously the archers are shooting in through the
entire
hedge
time.
Into the French knights. Again, the initial cavalry charge shot to pieces. Like, the horses going down, everyone falling over, blah, blah. The same story as Cressy.
So, havoc going on while they're trying to get over this edge. Like, everyone's dying. You're running up a hill, everyone's dying around you.
Yeah, and you're trying to get through this big, like, proper hedgerow, like, you know, thick earth bank, everything else. Not just a bush, like, you know, a garden bush, but it's like a earth bank and thick barrier. And there's a whole bunch of fucking angry English guys on the other side poking you with sticks and spears and everything mm-hmm. else.
Not having a good time.
The French just send wave after wave of men. They order their knights off of their horses and they're coming on foot trying to get through this hedge. And they're just being shot down and, you know, hacked down by the English defenders. Wave after wave just launching and dying on these English defences. The contemporary chroniclers at this point describe John II as realising, oh fuck, I've brought all my sons to the slaughter, I need to get them the fuck out of here, and ordering his sons off the battlefield. Mm-hmm. The other French forces see the princes retreating, they're like, oh shit, it's a retreat, and they start to flee. Yeah. And the English sense victory is coming. The youngest son, Philip, he goes back to the king to stay with him, the other three sons fuck off. Philip, who's only 14 years old at this point, stays with the king, and as the English are coming in, the last French attack goes forward, the king's in there in the mix in the fight, and Philip's with him, fighting alongside, defending him with his shield, calling out targets and warning him of dangers to his left and his right, and they're fighting away, but eventually they're overwhelmed by the English as the French army crumbles and breaks away, and the king is forced to surrender. The target in medieval warfare is to make the rich targets surrender so you'll get the ransom for them rather than killing them.
Yeah.
So the king and his young son Philip are captured. Catastrophic defeat again for the French. But Philip, the 14-year-old prince, becomes a national hero, like this boy he was fighting alongside defending his father. He becomes known as Le Hardy, or the Bold. Mm-hmm. And this I'm going to refer to him from now on as Philip the Bold. 1360, a few years later, peace is signed. France hands over one third of its territory to England. It agrees to pay 3 million écus, which I have no idea how much that is worth, but it sounds like a lot.
Sounds like a bit, yeah.
To pay for the king.
Buy you a couple of Renault Espaces.
Yeah, I think so. Possibly a Citroën C5 as well. So peace is signed in 1360, but France is deeply fucked. Like, the country's been devastated by this English chevauchee, this way of fighting, of just destroying the countryside. Obviously, the plague has been fucking going on the whole time, been spread by the armies marching around as well. And the English army is full of mercenaries, like, you know, professional English soldiers, German mercenaries, whatever. Suddenly their source of income has gone away, so they just become bandits raiding the countryside. The French armies have just been destroyed twice in the space of 10 years. There's nothing to stop them. So France is deeply, deeply fucked by all of this going on. In this context, you know, with this plague everywhere, fucking apocalypse happening, over in Burgundy, there was a duke still from the Capet family, a guy named Philip of Rouvray, I think it's pronounced, the last living House Capet member. He catches the plague and dies. 2 years later, the King of France rewards his youngest son, Philip the Bold, by making him the Duke of Burgundy to reward him for his bravery in the Battle of Poitiers. And Philip the Bold is the first of our Valois Dukes of Burgundy. This is the beginning of the Burgundian state that we're going to talk about for the rest of this series.
Ah, okay, so that's where it all comes from.
That's where it all begins.
No, it's okay, so Burgundian Duke dies, French inherit, I'm guessing then.
It goes back to the King of France, and he hands it out to his youngest son,
that's where the story begins.
Philip the Bold, and that's where it begins.
Is that where we're ending it?
And we'll leave it there. Next time we'll look at...
Nice, I like that. Yeah, intro episode. Yeah, cool.
So next time we'll look at the life of Philip the Bold and how we go from just one French duchy amongst many to something that's going to end up becoming the richest, most powerful state in Western Europe in the 15th century.
Nice. Okay, nice. So I've got a bit of historical knowledge about from now onwards, but
right.
I don't know how much of it's real and how much of it's computer games. So that's nice, bruv. Nice. Alright. Well, I suppose we'll wrap it up there then.
Yeah, we can wrap it up
there. Nice place to leave it. As always, email us and that. Give me a call.
Yeah, you can reach us on the X, formerly known as Twitter, at Makers of History. You can email us at wearemakersofhistory. If you've enjoyed what you've listened to, please rate and review us on your podcast venue of choice.
Yeah, on Spotify you can rate now, can't you? And we've only had 5-star reviews, which is quite nice.
Which is good, we don't have to pay for them anymore now.
Yeah. Please drop a like or comment or whatever you
can do. It helps
us out.
It helps a lot. It makes it more visible.
Plus, it's higher up the list, you know what I mean?
If you know someone that would like to listen to a podcast about the Valois Dukes of Burgundy, then please tell your friends, tell your nan, tell people on the internet.
Yeah.
Shout it out the window at strangers.
Yeah. Don't tell any shady folk, though.
Yeah. No one that's really tall that keeps doing suspiciously well.
Yeah. Fuckers. Right. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.